Okay. So recording has begun? The audio recording has begun. Okay, we're just not seeing it here. Oh, it is. Okay, I'm watching the Board of Supervisors, so it's a little disconcerting, but okay. All right, we'll bring the Monday, February 22nd meeting of the City Council to order and let the record show that all council members are present. There we are. Okay, thank you. All right, we'll begin our meeting with a moment of silence. Thank you. To lead us in the pledge tonight, we have some young ladies from the future and gentlemen from the Future Farmers of America. And would you just come up to the podium and lead us in the pledge, please?
Ready? Salute. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. We'll hear a little bit more about you later. Very soon, actually. Okay, so for announcements. First of all, I just have to say what a great 50th anniversary party it was at the aquarium. If you missed it, yeah, missed a good one. It was just so wonderful to celebrate that with the Tylers and their family and
We spoke in favor of the homeless campus in downtown San Luis near the airport, and we had to get, I think it was six out of the eight or five out of the seven commissioners' approval for this, and we did, and it was a huge hurdle, so now it'll go before the City Council, who I understand supports the endeavor too, so that was real good news. And at the risk of inciting public insurrection or rioting in the streets, I should probably announce that I did pull papers for mayor last week, and we'll have plenty of time to talk about that later. So,
good. Yeah.
All right. Did you submit your papers of insanity as well?
That's kind of
that's okay. Part of the application these days.
Certification. I just wanted to, good evening, everyone. I wanted to update you all on the two of the boards that I sit on behalf of the council and the city. The first is with the Air Pollution Control District, San Luis County. I mentioned this about a month and a half ago that there is a really it's a controversial study and discussion regarding air pollution on the Napomo Mesa, which has been an issue that concerning public health and the impacts of the particulate matter that is really high in the Napomo Mesa. And the Air Pollution Control District, working with some other groups, have been studying the issue, and those results, the South County Particulate Matter Study, have been actually finalized and are now ready for public presentation. I have not seen those results. The APCD board has not seen those results, but there is going to be a public workshop on March 3rd. That's a Wednesday, from 6 to 9 p.m. at the South County Regional Center, that's 800 West Branch Street in Arroyo Grande, where those results will be discussed, presented. There will be time for the public to ask questions, and it should be a really interesting discussion and basically lay the groundwork then for our Air Pollution Control District meeting on the 24th of March, where the board is going to actually be presented those results formally, and we'll have some dialogue about where we'd like to see activity go from there. It's hard to speculate as to what that might be, but it's receiving a fair amount of news already. I'm getting some contact from people from around the county because the results do show some impacts. This is a preliminary way from the off-road riding area. So it's a contentious issue. It should be really interesting to see where it goes. And for anyone who would like more details, the website for APCD, the Air Pollution Control District, is slocleanair.org. And the contact person, if you'd like to talk directly to a staff member, is Erin Arlen Janae, and her number is 781-5998. And for those of you who don't know, the APCD board is comprised of representatives of every member of the community and the five board of supervisors. So it should be a really spicy discussion, and I'll look forward to keeping you updated on how that proceeds. The other board that I sit on is the National Estuary Program, and we've had some internal discussions with the council members and also members of the community that relate to a study that was recently completed by a couple members of Cal Poly biology departments focused on pollution impacts in the estuary, most notably the nonyl phenol results that have shown potentially significant issues with what these pollutants are doing to the ecosystem in the estuary. And nonyl phenol is a pollutant that basically is derived from petrochemicals and petroleum products, and is pretty prevalent in what we do in our communities. It's involved with detergents and cleaners and things that we have on the shelves. It's not accurately labeled. It's very often included as an inert other ingredient when you look at the ingredients of lists. So there's not a lot known about it. This study has provided us some really interesting and concerning preliminary details. There definitely needs to be more work done, but it's significant enough and prevalent enough throughout the West Coast and the world that we need to take some action towards this. And the reason I bring it up is some of the council and myself have expressed interest in helping to support the public awareness and perhaps regulation of nonyl phenol, as the European Union and Canada have done, at least with labeling and in some cases banning the use of those substances. So there's a couple of other discussion is the second State of the Bay conference, and that's scheduled for May 14th, 15th, tentatively at this point. So we'll look forward to more dialogue and opportunities to talk about how we can take care of our estuary.
Carla?
I need to apologize for not reporting on that marine interest group meeting that I sat in representing the city last time. I think it was because I couldn't say the word nonylphenol. They also
I don't think I'm saying it right.
Nonylphenol, I believe. Is that what it is? Nonylphenol. Yeah. I'd have to look at Rick Elgert for that. Mr. Elgert knows. Two of the other things that they did talk about when I sat in that meeting was about the studies that are being done here in our bay on the ocean floors since the drag boats and trawling things have changed in the ban, and how they repopulate once they've had some time. So they're studying that, and also the use of styrofoam, so and the effects that it has on our estuary. So those are the three things they were looking at. Integrated waste management, I had no meeting, but I know since we're talking about the water contaminants tonight, I would just want to take an opportunity to remind people that there are places available, unfortunately not here in town yet, but hopefully in Morro Bay soon, if the new pharmacy comes in for a medication take back at Cambria Pharmacy and Gifts. So that's our closest one. Otherwise, you go to San Luis rather than disposing of them in the water system or in your trash where they'll end up in the grounds. So the other committee I sit on, the Economic Vitality Committee, has been very busy the last few weeks. It seems like that's all I've been doing, but I don't know that any of it's any great news. I attended a business symposium, and the day before that at the Economic Vitality Committee meeting, Congressman McCarthy attended and gave us an update on just some small business initiatives and things that are being proposed in the state. He also was instrumental in helping get a grant for the airport that Mr. Manchek was giving us, the airport study for $500,000 that they're going to use to help bring possibly other airlines or increase flights out of there. So that was a positive note. But the symposium was just talking about how to grow business in our community and what makes it a viable community, and that was pretty much the same direction that the congressman was addressing that to with the small businesses. So that's it. That's all I have for now.
Okay. And our business representative tonight is Patrick Mahan from the Fun Ride, the Greenway to Drive. Patrick, are you here? Come tell us about the Fun Way to Drive.
Okay, great. Again, I'm Patrick Mahan. I'm the Director of Operations for Fun Ride. We recently joined the chamber here in Morro Bay with the intent of bringing a car out to Morro Bay. We're a car sharing service, and for those of you who aren't familiar with car sharing, you have the benefits of private car use without the responsibilities of all the ownership. And the cars are rented by the hour, and the rates include the fuel and the insurance. I can tell you that the city and the county of San Luis Obispo have already signed up. The city of San Luis Obispo is giving us a parking spot right as you get off the main bus in the city hall parking lot. So you'll be able to go into San Luis Obispo on a bus and walk 50 feet and be able to get to a private car for your personal use. The city plans on utilizing it to reduce their fleet with AB 32 legislation. There's requirements that CO2 emissions be reduced by 50% by 2020. So one of the things that makes our service unique is we only use alternative fuel vehicles. So we have a hybrid electric, we have natural gas, and we have flex fuel currently. This is a great way to reduce fleet dependency and also monitor the amount of use that vehicles are getting, because each individual that drives a car checks it out, and you know when they took it and when they brought it back. It allows you to have a fixed cost for transportation, because the variable of repair and maintenance and registration and all of the other, the list goes on and on. So we want to come to Morro Bay. We are going to come to Morro Bay, but one of the things that we would like to see the city help us do is to get 30 members signed up. We don't want to bring a $25,000 car and park it and wait for people to get a clue about what it's there for. What we would like to do is encourage people to sign up. Once we have 30 members, we will then bring a car out. And let's see, there's another point that I would like to make also for the private business community. When you have somebody drive a vehicle on your behalf for your business, you're paying, I believe it's 54 cents a mile currently. That's correct, or it's somewhere in that range. Our service, to give you an example, is when a business joins, they pay a nominal membership fee, but they're able to rent the car for $5 an hour and 30 cents a mile. So if they're paying employees 54 cents a mile, they could be saving 24 cents a mile just by utilizing one of our cars. And then on top of that, they're all alternative fuels. Okay. Statistics right now, there's a number of studies that have been done at Berkeley, MIT. Frost and Sullivan is a major business analyst. They are stating for every car that's shared, 9 to 13 cars are taken off the road. When people car share, they're a lot less. 60% of them are actually not buying a second car. In San Luis Obispo County, 61% of the households have more than one car. And in these tough economic times, you can utilize a car sharing service of public transportation and get rid of your second car. And it can be a dramatic saving. So we service government, individuals, private business, and the tourist industry. We think we'd be a tremendous asset to the city and to the whole coastal community. I've lived in Cayucas for 25 years, and I know that with a car or two in Morro Bay, it will draw people from Los Osos as well as Cayucas, and we've even already have people signed up in Cambria for our service. So,
how do we sign up? if people are interested that are watching this, how would they go about signing up? How do they contact you?
There's a couple ways. You can go online to myfunride.com. Okay. What I would like to do is just start an initiative in the city, either. And I've worked, met with the city, the Chamber of Commerce. But if we could just get a sign-up list going around, and we would not sign anybody up until the car was in the community, so that we could just get the initial 30 people signed up, and then once we bring the car out, then boom, we activate everybody. And then if anybody did want to utilize the cars prior to that, we would just sign them up.
Okay, so the Chamber has already started a list as well, then?
I'm going to be working with the Chamber. Okay. I just joined just recently, and so they've contacted me to come here tonight, and so going to be getting a list, and through the Chamber, we hope to generate those 30 folks and get the car out here as soon as possible.
Okay. So website or through the Chamber, if people that are interested in watching can sign up. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Staff reports first. Sorry. Police. Please, Chief.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. There's a couple statistics from the past couple weeks. Since February 1st, we had a total of 828 incidents, which include 377 calls for service. We had 80 incident reports, 71 crimes reported, and 26 arrests. And the real good news, we swore in our newest officer, Stephanie Pippen, last week, and she's begun her field training program. And those of you that have met her, you'll agree she's going to be a great fit for this community. So we're lucky to have her. And as a result of competitive testing process, Pat Line, one of our existing dispatchers, was selected to replace Rich Rawlson, who's retiring at the end of this week after 17 years as our dispatcher and dispatch supervisor. Pat did an outstanding job in the testing process and came out on top. So the other good thing about that is there was four experienced dispatchers that were invited to the Aura Board, and three passed. And so with Pat's promotion, we'll create another dispatcher vacancy with Rich's retirement. And so we've begun a background process on one of the other applicants that's agreed to be a dispatcher with us instead of the dispatch supervisor. And this applicant lives here in Morro Bay. So that's a double positive. We also began the background on the reserve position we spoke about previously to you that you approved, and so some good things happening. That's all I have to report.
Thank you. Chief Pond?
Yes. Oh, thank you.
Good evening, Mayor and Council. I'm going to keep mine fairly brief here. I wanted to remind everybody that we are doing a fuel modification in the state park. It's a state park project with the three C's, and they're going to be beginning work this week, weather permitting. Also, there's also a group that's doing some burning in the state park. The piles that were left over from last year that are all dried, now's the great time to burn while everything else is green. And so if you saw some light smoke up on...
going to be doing a little brief description of some budget issues, some answers to questions you always wanted to know about the budget but were perhaps afraid to ask. So that's featured in the Loop e-newsletter. And lastly, speaking of budget time, tonight we're having a public hearing asking the community about their thoughts on our budget. We'll also be having a public hearing on March 8th to get additional information from the general public. And then an hour prior to our goals workshop on March 16th, we'll be taking public comment. Of course, the public can answer or give us information or ideas on anything they would like to, but we're hoping that they answer two specific questions for us in order to work on our budget this year. And those questions are, in these difficult budget times, what city services are most important to you? And then kind of a second, a little fuzzier question is, what do you value about Morro Bay? And if people are uncomfortable coming to the podium, they can always email me their information as well. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. And closed session report, Rob?
Yes. Good evening. Prior to tonight's regular session, Council met in closed session to discuss real property transactions. The two property discussed was 625 Harbor Street, the library, and 781 Market Street. No final action was taken, but as to the 625 Harbor Street library, Council did direct staff to negotiate a transition plan for the use of the program room to library use.
Okay. Thank you. And Council, if you will, please allow me to pull A8 and A9 for approval from our consent agenda. We have some people here that want to receive those proclamations. Okay.
Second.
Rick and Betty, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Okay. It was Betty that seconded, right? Okay. And if I could have, let's see, we'll do them both. Let's start with the Spay Day USA. And we have Diana. Talk about it, but I'll just read a little bit of it. Whereas humane societies and animal shelters have to put down more than 4 million cats, dogs, and rabbits each year, many of whom are healthy and adoptable due to a lack of critical resources and public awareness, and spaying and neutering has been shown to dramatically reduce the overpopulation of pets and feral cats, proving to be a wise investment in saving animal lives and taxpayer dollars. Therefore, be it resolved by the City Council of the City of Morro Bay that February 23rd, 2010, is designated Spay Day USA. The City Council is authorized and requested to issue a proclamation calling upon the citizens of Morro Bay to observe the day by having their own cats, dogs, and rabbits spayed or neutered, or by sponsoring the spaying or neutering of another person's pet. So if you've already been responsible with your own, help your neighbor too. And now, Diana, you can add anything you want to.
Get those neighbor's pets too. Very important. Thank you. We thank the City of Morro Bay every year. It's very important. On behalf of all the rescuers and the groups in this county, we thank you all. The City of Morro Bay has every year been extremely supportive for Heart and all the groups in this county. And it's funny too. I'm writing a grant right now, and I do need to leave here real soon. And I was just going back through all my notes And I came across many pictures and many notes. And one of my first recollections, one of my big projects, was clearing Morro Bay Rock of 46 cats back in 1997, I think it was, with the help of a grant from Morro Bay City, a $2,500 grant from Morro Bay City. That was quite a big project, and we cleared them all in a month. And there better not be any more cats there right now. And I don't think there have been since 1997. Anyway, that was a big project. And we thank you all, and we thank you for your continuous support every year. So thank you. This has been very important. Thank you.
Okay, and Peggy and group. They are here for National FFA Week. Whereas the FFA and agriculture education provide a strong foundation for the youth of America and the future of the food, fiber, and natural resources systems, the FFA promotes premier leadership, personal growth, and career success among its members. The FFA motto, learning to do, learning to learn, doing to learn, earning to live, living to serve, gives direction of purpose to these students who take an active role in succeeding in agricultural education. Therefore, be it resolved by the City Council of the City of Morro Bay that February 20th to 27th, 2010 is designated as National FFA Week. And there's your proclamation, and please feel free to make your own comment.
First off, I would just like to thank the City Council for giving us the opportunity to be here today. We're going to start off with introducing
National Convention in Indianapolis. Every conference allows members to learn skills like communication, critical thinking, becoming a leader, and teamwork. Not only do they learn these important life skills, but they get to have fun while doing it. Attending these conferences allows members to have a chance to meet people from all over California, and in some cases, the entire United States, all while having a good time and fighting ag illiteracy.
The FFA also offers a variety of public speaking contests and teams. The Prepare Public Speaking and Job Interview Contests prepare the contestants for real-world scenarios like speaking to a group and job interviews. The Parley Pro, or the debate team, does a mock meeting while using parliamentary procedure to get the meeting well done. Specialty Animal focuses on animals, what they do, how they breed, and identifying them. farm power, troubleshoots, and drives tractors as well as other farm equipment. There are also contests designed just for first-year FFA students or green hands, such as our Creed Recitation and the Best Informed Green Hand.
What I have learned in my 4 years as an FFA member will stay with me and help me be prepared for the rest of my life. The great thing about the FFA is attaining those life skills and knowing that everything a member learns can help them in their future. The mission of the FFA is creating premier leadership, personal growth, and career success, and that's exactly what it does. The first and greatest skill the FFA perfects is that of speech. One of people's greatest fears in life is public speaking, but the FFA quickly puts that fear to rest. Secondly, the FFA teaches its members how to be professional. Our precise uniform and useful mannerisms, such as how to properly shake someone's hand, introducing and thanking a speaker, and parliamentary law, creates strong leadership. Lastly, the FFA puts its members into real-life situations, such as career development events, record-keeping, and even mock job interviews, which is something we all have to go through in life. It is easy to see the FFA is truly beneficial for preparing students for the life ahead, and every member should be proud of their growth and accomplishments.
At the Morro Bay FFA chapter, we are about more than just animals and agriculture. We are about leadership, cooperation, and being involved in the community. Although, looking at the animal side of Morro Bay FFA, we have great opportunities. At the high school, we have an FFA animal farm on grounds available to all students taking an animal to the fair. Also, during the summer, the California Mid-State Fair is a great opportunity for our students taking an animal to learn about financial responsibility, time management, and livestock care. The Morro Bay FFA has many successful fundraisers and activities. We, for example, we have football barbecues and drive-through barbecues held at our school. And after every FFA meeting, we have fun activities such as pumpkin carving in October and gingerbread house building in December. And one of our largest events is the upcoming barn dance on May 22nd at Swallow Creek Ranch. And this dance is just for adults, and it's a big fundraiser for school farm cleanup and scholarships.
As you can see, the FFA offers to its members and to everyone worldwide just kind of an opportunity to gain, to build their leadership skills and develop skills that will help them throughout their whole life. From the National Convention to individual activities at our chapter, the FFA strives to keep its members involved. I would just like to thank you guys again for giving us this opportunity and giving us this proclamation, which we thank you so much.
You know, I have to say, your public speaking training is really showing, because that was wonderful. All of you, that was beautifully presented. Thank you very much for being here. Okay, now we're getting to our general public comment. And last meeting, David Weissman spoke briefly at public comment, and then we let someone else on the topic he was interested in speak for longer when we got to the topic and he was no longer here. So I promised David that he could speak first tonight and address his issue a little more fully. So, David, you want to come up? I'm sorry?
6 minutes. Thank you. David Weissman, a Morro Bay resident, Alliance for Nuclear Responsibility, and I thank you for the opportunity to come back this evening and address the issue. I did watch businesses and have multiple electrical demands. That will mean something entirely different, more. And what we have said, and what the letter which was presented last week said, was that the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which has accepted a process of renewing the license for Diablo Canyon for 20 more years, wait, hold this in abeyance until the studies that the state wants to do first are completed. And the state studies are indeed interested in economics.
What are the cost, benefits, and risks of this, vis-a-vis particularly newly discovered seismic information? And that, it would seem to us, is the prudent thing to do. If you have a process that's going to take this long and cost $85 million, and there's a $16 million part of it here that could answer a critical question, the key would be to answer that question, we would think, here at the beginning, get that out of the way before you spend the $68 million other dollars. Pacific Gas and Electric erred a bit in their answer to you last year when they said, or last week, when they said that this timeline was very inclusive. Actually, Ms. Winholtz attended the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's presentation a week ago. And if you'd seen the PowerPoint slide, which they had presented for the timeline, they have the reactor being licensed by the end of 2011. That was the timeline they presented in their PowerPoint presentation. The difference is when you read Pacific Gas and Electric's application for the funding for the seismic studies as required by the state, you will discover that they are intending to complete them for their long-term study in 2013 or 2014, which is 2 years after, theoretically, the plant could be relicensed. Now, we would think that the state, who has, by the way, said as well, this is a requirement for the state. It may not be, as we point out. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission does not require this to be done. But then they don't live here. They don't pay our electric bills. This letter is a letter from the president of the Public Utilities Commission to the chairman of Pacific Gas and Electric. And in it he writes, "It has come to my attention that PG&E does not believe that it should include a seismic study and other AB 1632 recommendations as part of its Diablo Canyon license extension studies. Apparently, PG&E bases this position on the fact that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's license renewal application does not require that such a study be included within the scope of its application. This position, however, does not allow the Public Utilities Commission to undertake its obligations to ensure plant reliability, grid reliability, in the event of a prolonged outage or permanent outage. Therefore, we direct PG&E to complete the following tasks: report on major findings and conclusions for the seismic tsunami studies as recommended by Assemblyman Blakesley's bill, Assembly Bill 1632. And he concludes, PG&E's rate case specifically linked PG&E's license renewal feasibility study for Diablo Canyon to the AB 1632 seismic assessment, and PG&E is obligated to address the above itemized issues in its plant relicensing application. This commission will not be able to adequately and appropriately exercise its authority to fund and oversee Diablo Canyon's license extension without these issues being fully developed." Now, again, that funding, remember, is your funding. We all pay for this process. It is passed on to us as consumers. It is electricity bill. It's in your electric bill, like it or not. And so, once again, we come before you asking that you consider asking the Nuclear Regulatory Commission at the federal level to say, hey, our state has some significant questions. They do fit within the timeline. The study can be done within a year, can be done in the first year of a multi-year process and been placed out of the way. Historically, we have seen what happens when this policy is not followed. Everyone remembers, who's old enough to remember, the 1980s, when, in fact, the cost escalation for Diablo Canyon was passed along to ratepayers at $4.4 billion because of studies that weren't done. These were the famous studies that they forgot. The Tribune, you find these old articles from Thursday of 1981. 14-year cover-up, PG&E declined to pursue fault. We remember what happens if we don't do the right things first. And so, once again, although we ask the full board to consider this letter again, we will happily accept and be proud of a letter from the two council members who so indicated. I will personally reference that letter when, a week from this Thursday, I sit in the office opposite the chairman of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission outside of Washington, D.C., when we meet with him to bring these concerns to him and his full organization. And it would be certainly important if the entire city was in agreement, but we will certainly represent the point of views who do of those who are willing to. Thank you.
Thank you, David. And again, I'm sorry about not giving you the chance last meeting. Okay, public comment period.
Good evening. My name is Janet Gould, and I'm the principal of Delmar Elementary School.
My name is Mauro Salazar, and I am a fifth grade student. We've created a video of our variety show, and we recorded a commercial for our upcoming production.
Tonight we'd like to show you a 2-minute video of what we did for our production.
I want to see that variety show one.
Sunday, March 21st, 1 to 4 in the afternoon.
Remember, right here in at Del Mar in the multi-purpose room.
Is that all?
Of course not.
All the kids get to play games outside and win candy.
You can also win big money from the cow plot.
That's a lot of stuff. But wait, we're just getting started.
We forgot to mention the food.
There's going to be a barbecue and lots of other goodies.
But most importantly is the art auction, where people can buy beautiful, exquisite art pieces
made by the creative students at Del Mar.
There will also be other items available for purchase.
And if you own a local business and have items or talents you'd like to donate, contact Joan Solo
at 459-3274. Again, 459-3274. Let's see what I can buy.
Well, there's this beautiful heart made by our wonderful kindergartners.
I almost forgot. This chair I'm sitting in is made by our wonderful fourth grade class.
I'm not going to miss it. Let's see that info on the screen again.
We'll see you there.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
Good evening. My name is Bill Martini. That's a tough one.
Yeah, tough act to follow.
Actually, I came here tonight to speak about the lease of the Morro Bay Library that was discussed in closed door. It sounds like it's heading in the right direction. And what I was going to bring up was if there was a squeeze on the community center and you have the modular next door at the fire station that's going to be either abandoned or surplus, and my thought was, and you probably even already got it figured out, is to use that surplus building for what is currently being, the conference or the community center at the library. But it sounds like you're going in the right direction. But that's one thought, is you have a surplus building when the fire department is completed, and that could work. It's in the same parking lot as the library, and you could expand and maybe modify that building for the purpose of, a meeting room. So thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Jack McCurdy. I'm a Morro Bay resident. I want to address one single issue and two points to it. The issue, of course, is the Morro Bay Library and the refusal of the city for going on 10 years to allow the Friends of the Library in the county to use the program room, the 1,500 square foot program room for library services. And I want to make two points. I did make these points in emails to the council members today, but I just wanted to reemphasize them and also allow the community to understand what the points I made. One is that Although it's been alleged falsely that there are no feasible and effective alternatives to the program room for meetings of organizations, community organizations, we did a survey, a quick survey around the community, and we found numerous alternatives among churches, hotels, motels, banks, public facilities, and other sites around Mobile. Crystal clear that it is not provided for in either lease that this is to be used anything else besides library uses. And therefore, the city has no legal grounds to stand as it has in the past. And I trust the good judgment of the majority of this council to appreciate that and recognize those legal realities and pursue the right course. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening, Madam Mayor, members of the council. My name is John Barta. A few months ago, I got up here and I suggested that we should get busy trying to put together some shovel-ready proposals for the federal government. Well, last week, they unveiled a website. I don't know if they unveiled it last week, but I heard about it last week, called recovery.gov, recovery.gov. And I went there, and I put in zip code 93442. And what I found out is we've been doing pretty well. Thank you very much. We've gotten over $200,000 for the NEP, and we've gotten some Caltrans projects going here in town. And one really, really big one, Chief Pond, $1.6 million for the new fire station. So I just thought that for those out there with a jaundiced view of what government can and cannot do, you know, you guys are doing a good job, and it's good news. Thanks.
Thank you. Staff works hard for those grants.
My name is Alice Kolb. I'm a resident here in town, and I'm here tonight to say thank you to the fire department. On the morning of January 21st of this year, I was alerted by a family member that there was a lot of water coming into our backyard. Steps leading from an upper level of the yard to our patio had become a waterfall. There was also water shooting out of a hole at the base of our retaining wall. The patio was so full of water that it soon would have come into the house. I called 911, and the fire department responded quickly. They arrived with large squeegees, shovels, and picks. After sending my son to buy a sump pump, they helped us sweep water to a drain. They improvised a diversion of the water using bags of fertilizer that were in the patio. They also searched for and found the source of all this water. There's an underground spring at the highest level of our property. A small trench was created to carry water to the pasture land behind our home. While they helped us, the rain continued to come down, but the downstairs portion of our home was saved from being flooded. We're very grateful for their rapid response and their knowledge of what was needed. It may not be their most dramatic act this year, but it meant a lot to us, and we wanted to say thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else?
Zeke Turley, AGP Video. I just wanted to let you know, everybody know, that we're going to be playing the Morro Bay Aquarium 50th Anniversary DVD directly after the city council meeting and throughout the week so that people can see it. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else? Okay, we'll bring it back to the council. Before we go to break, I just want to know how... Oh, first of all, any comments on comments?
No. I was just telling Noah we should get her address and maybe pump that water to our treatment facility.
Okay. What I'd like to do, we have some staff people that can go if we approve most of our consent agenda. Betty wanted to pull A4. Anyone else want to pull anything off consent? Can I hear a motion approving A1, 2, 3, 5, 6, and 7, please?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Okay, and with that, we'll take a short break. Oh, sorry. I'm waiting. There we are. Okay. All right, we're back, and we're going to go ahead with item B1, which is the discussion on the fiscal year 2010-11 budget and priorities. Andrea?
Good evening, Council. You approved your budget calendar at your February 8th meeting, and at that meeting you discussed the need to have additional public hearings concerning the budget to give the public the opportunity to provide input on our budget process this year. Again, as I talked about in my update, we're asking the public to really provide us with any information that they would think is important in formation of the budget for next fiscal year, but specifically we're asking them to answer two questions during these difficult budget times: what city services are most important to you, and then the second question is, what do you value
in architecture, and what caused me to move here to Morro Bay instead of another city in the county was, wow, what a quiet, neat, fresh air, funky little beach town. I so miss that. And the thing that I love the most and what kept me here is the fact that there's that beautiful ocean out there, fresh air, room to breathe, and move, and I can walk anywhere in the city day or night and feel safe. It's a friendly town, and I love that. And as far as priorities, you've got a lot of tough decisions ahead, but when we get as tight as we are with money nationally and probably getting worse, you need to look at some core things. So for me, my opinion, public safety, critical youth programs, and, you know, transportation. You have public safety to make it safe so we can keep walking. You've got good youth programs so that you don't raise another generation of people with antisocial behavior who end up adding to crime, and a way for the people to get around in a nice community. So that's my input, and thank you very much. And if there's anything else as far as saving money within public safety, I'd like to ask you to retain the commander position rather than spend the additional thousands of dollars for switching to an administrative sergeant. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Virginia Warren from Virginia Hiramatsu from Morro Bay. And to me, one of the most important things here in Morro Bay is the police department. It's relatively a very safe town, but at the same time, I'm seeing more and more crime going on. And there's times when I'm listening to the scanner, and sometimes the officers are going from call to call to call. And when I first moved here, it wasn't like that, but it's been getting busier and busier. And one of the things I agree with Vicki is that the commander position needs to be saved. If you put in an administrative sergeant for that, they're going to be putting in hours and hours of overtime for what the commander does now at his salary. So my plea is to please save the commander position and keep the police department fully in force. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Stephanie Finlay. I'm a full-time resident in North Morro Bay, and I would say what I enjoy about Morro Bay is our general lifestyle, the quiet, the security, the wonderful area and location, and I think what makes that so special is we've been able to provide good public safety, both fire and police. And in fact, that's one of the reasons my husband and I chose to live here rather than another community, because of those services being offered. And he's out of town, but I speak for him also. We would like to see those services continued at least at the levels they are now. I know that the police department especially has been stripped down to bare minimum, and the thought of losing the commander's position just puts more of a burden on the few officers that are remaining. And they, with the increase in calls and the probable increase that will continue, and the need for general public safety for both the youth and the elderly, I would hope you will consider seriously keeping the commander position. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Pete Maskell. Council members, this evening on behalf of Shoreline Calvary Chapel, we've been in the community for about 15 years, and if you know the old Morro Bay Elementary School, we've been there for about six. This evening, on behalf of Shoreline, I would like to address the question, in difficult budget times, what city services are the most important to us? And specifically, we would like to comment on the city security and the Morro Bay Police Department funding as one of those priorities. In the last 14 months, we've been broken into what we consider four times around the new year of last year. End of January last year, property stolen. Perpetrators were caught within about an hour, and I would, of course, like to give props to the Morro Bay Police Department for that. And that includes tracing an insufficiently marked property the same evening, contacting us, doing the investigation. A break-in. Council members, we would like to recommend that you consider continuing to fund or increasing the funding of the Morro Bay Police Department. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to speak? Okay, we'll close the public hearing section and remind everyone watching at home that we're going to have this again at our next meeting, so feel free to come and offer your comments as well. Council members, any comments at this point?
The only one that came to mind is a couple of our speakers tonight have rolled up their sleeves and actively participated volunteering with our police department. That's especially appreciated right now because those volunteer roles play a key element for us to be able to offer quality services with a really familiar and caring face. So that's always appreciated in whatever department you'd like to get involved with. We encourage you to do so, and there are certainly opportunities to do so.
Okay. Any other comments? All right. Then let's move on to our consent agenda item A4. Betty, you wanted that one pulled for discussion?
Yes, thank you. I had emailed Mr. Waite several questions that he answered today, which I appreciate in order to understand the difference under his discussion. I was wondering, because there is a chart attached, if he could help distinguish for me, under the Morro Basin, you have potable water and non-potable. So in the discussion from our email, because I haven't been back to beyond that initial contact, the potable, is that the $4 million that goes directly into the system then?
Yeah, thank you actually for pulling this. As I dug in and answered your question today, I went and reprinted the records. Since I originally printed them off, they've been audited by my staff, and they found an error that I made. So I have to admit to my mistake, and I've got a corrected version up on the board. In that instance, it actually drops from $4 million down to $1.8 million is the correction. So I picked the wrong well as the potable one. That water was...
Could you say that again, because we can't really...
Sure. It's $1.8 million from on the report. I believe it was 4.8.
Okay. So it's 1.8 instead of 4.
4.3.
4.3.
Yeah, you got it. And you go, that potable water in that instance is water that went directly into the system. So that's water that we blended in. And used directly. And it's been kind of a nightmare for us. This is a new way to operate. And so we're kind of struggling on the record-keeping side to make sure that we're keeping it straight as well. But that is correct.
And so then the non-potable, the $18 million, this doesn't reflect as being treated as part of production?
No, it doesn't. And the reason for that is through treatment you have losses. So this is our total production. We use this report for a couple of purposes. One of them is reporting on our water rights and how much we've used under our permits. So that it actually goes from $18 million down to $16 million with the corrections that were made. That water is the feed water. The non-potable is the feed water for the BWRO process. And so we didn't want to double count that. And so we actually count it down below under the total potable. And we have a little RO line down there in the gray box, sort of all the way down at the bottom of 10,359,840 gallons.
So then my there's no way that this $16 million could ever cover for us what's coming out of the Chorro Basin because it's not treated correctly or can't be or it's got a different purpose.
That water is what creates the RO product mm-hmm. in this case. So basically, as we run the $16 million through treatment, we get $10 million out the back end. That's effectively what that water is. So the Moro is being treated through the desal plant right now. That can offset the Chorro, and it gets more complicated as you run the blends. I have to track the nitrate levels of each of the sources and balance the nitrate levels. It's sort of a constant juggling game that you do.
So the $16 million becomes $10 million, plus we have the 1.8. Okay. And then the Chorro's all the way it is, $8 million.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Other questions for Dylan? No? Okay. Yes, Rick.
On page 2, Dylan, under Chorro groundwater, what's the current stream flow CFS that you're detecting now that you say you're testing for it twice a week?
Yeah, actually, I have that with me. I got it emailed to me today. The current stream flow measured on February 22nd was 13.6 CFS above Kinney Road and 16.7 CFS below.
Okay.
I do have a related question. I don't. It does have to do with the water report. My understanding is that staff's going up to Sacramento tomorrow mm-hmm. to talk to the water board. In closed session.
We'll probably have a closed session, but then there will also be other items that have to come up before you in open session also.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, do you want to do a motion, Betty?
I move approval of A4.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Okay. And we'll move on to item C1, authorization to add and hire a wastewater collection systems operator 2, Dylan.
All right. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. We brought this before you back in November. Really what this is, though, I wanted to kind of run through a little bit on the history more than anything else. The reason to request this position and the reason for this, the need for this position dates back to 2006. The state issued an edict, basically, that as a municipal wastewater collection system, we had the potential to spill. If we spilled, it would be illegal, and therefore they were regulating us under a general discharge permit. The requirements of that permit were preparation and adoption of a sanitary sewer management plan. So we began that process and worked on it and brought that before you kind of piece by piece as we got through it. And then finally we brought it to you for adoption in June of 2009. At that time, we adopted our sanitary sewer management plan. That plan consists of a number of specific elements that we say as part of maintaining our system, we're going to do all of these things. So we outlined, you know, there were 11 elements. We outlined what our approach was going to be for each one of them. We went into detail on them, and what we're doing now is we're actually moving from the planning phase into the implementation. As we do that, we've sort of realized that with the current staff that we have, we can't get to all of the activities that we're trying to get to. So what we're working on then is we've done sort of a work study. You guys saw that previously. I've put it back in your packet for tonight. To talk about and look at sort of hours of work that we think are out there, days of work that are out there, and what we find is that you know we have sufficient work for more than five bodies, but we're asking for another body in order to have two work crews. Right now we currently have one work crew and then sort of a management crew that does some work, but they also do a lot of the supervisory work, the reporting and things like that. The goal is to get ourselves to two full work crews and then have the supervisor sort of dip in. There are certain activities that require three workers rather than two workers, but almost all of the activities require at least two workers because of the hazards associated with working in and around. I mean, the manholes are always in the middle of the street, and so you have the traffic hazards as well as the hazards of the material that you're dealing with is extremely hazardous to human health. And so almost all of the tasks that they're pursuing require a two-man crew. You know, very few things. For the fog inspections, we'll send one guy out to do that because we know where they're going. they're in a restaurant, it's reasonably safe. But when they're working in a manhole or near a manhole or in an open manhole in the street, we don't send one guy out to do that. So the goal that we have is to get to two full work crews and then let the supervisor kind of rotate into a workman's position when they need a third man for the tasks. And so what we've outlined is the kind of the activities. We've put it in terms of the elements in the SSMP. We've done a best guess estimate on how much time we're going to be spending on each one of those activities. And then we've shown that we have more workload than can be supported by the current crew working at 100% efficiency. Granted, no crew in the city works at 100% efficiency. I'm not claiming my guys can do that. And their efficiency is improving, and we're adopting new tools and technologies constantly to sort of move in that direction and become more and more efficient. But we don't think we can get all the way where we need to with the crew that we have. And so we were directed to bring this back at mid-year or after mid-year budget, and we're doing that tonight. So I'd be happy to take any questions or answer any concerns that you might have in this regard.
Okay. Questions?
I have one at least. Okay. Is there a timetable associated with this from the state or from your goals, or how does that fit into this?
That's a good question. The SSMP we've adopted, we have to review it in 2 years. But the state hasn't done any inspections, so we don't have the regional board. I'm not going to claim that they've come out and are kind of upset with us. I don't think we've jeopardized our relationship, and we certainly are working on first things first. But there are tasks that we've sort of committed ourselves to as a city to perform. Specifically, one of the ones that we haven't put much attention to and we want to get into in a little more detail is INI reduction, where we work on sort of troubleshooting where the water is coming into the system that shouldn't be in the system. So, for example, you heard about the Lady Spring. A lot of times those springs will run overland and then wind up in a manhole, wind up in the wastewater treatment plant, and we're paying to treat that clean surfaces. And then also the global driver, though, is the compliance with the state mandate.
One follow-up question. So if we hire another person, then is the current supervisor going to get a bump up in addition to, or he stays at what he is even though he's supervising more people?
He stays at where he is. He's paid to supervise that division. Adding a staff person doesn't do anything to change his position, or mine, for that matter.
Any other questions? No?
Yeah, I did have a question for you, Dylan. I'd like you to talk a little bit about the savings that you've mentioned in the report in relation to contractual services. And are those existing contractual services or those that we're anticipating to need in the case that we don't make this hire and we continue to address the goals of the plan?
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for asking that. One of the tasks you guys asked me to look at is the cost of doing this work with our own crew versus doing it with an outside contractor. So the lower range of that cost savings is the $97.53. What I did was I took an average guy working in that division, and I took his salary, I took his benefits package, and I rolled it all up and divided it by the number of hours per year, assuming he was working 48 weeks per year, and came up with an hourly rate. And then I compared that hourly rate to the minimum legal requirement for prevailing wage rates. Because we're a prevailing wage rate city, that's kind of the tongue twister there, we have to pay a certain minimum legal amount. The fact is, though, is that you never actually just pay prevailing wage because contractors like a profit. And so anytime you hire an outside contractor, you actually add profits into that. So what I did on the upper end of that cost savings, the $108,192 per year, as I called, there's only really one local company that does sewer-type services. And I asked them, okay, I want to hire a guy full-time, bring him onto my crew, augment my crew, and use one of your guys sort of like an extension of staff. What would that run me per hour? The price that came back was $85 per hour. That wasn't a bidding process. That was an informal process. So I just basically called and got a quote. And that $108,000 per year represents the difference between the $85 per hour and our fully burdened, fully loaded costs for our employees. So that's where that range came from. Those costs, some of those actually have been contracted out. We do use contractors extensively, and hiring another person is not going to stop us from contracting out certain activities. But what this mostly is it's mostly a look to sort of future activities and some of the things we're not getting to if we contracted those out, you know, like the INI program. That's something we could contract out. If we did that, we would experience a cost difference, at a minimum legal cost difference of about $10,000 per year and a practical cost difference of at least $100,000 per year.
Any other questions?
Yes, okay. Let's go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I don't have any questions.
So if we don't approve this position, at your discretion, you could hire some of these activities out on your own.
Yeah, we would have to roll them into our we have a certain budget that we keep for contract activities, and we would roll these activities that we're not getting to into that process or budget amount.
Mm-hmm. When I look at this report and I look at A4, and in the fiscal impact on A4, it talks about the state water and how that's impacting us, and that we're not entertaining a rate increase at this point, but we may in the future. That's not said, but it's in, you know, anticipate that we're okay for now, but that if we get close, we'll start having to use reserves. Does this put us into that category where you're going to have to start using reserves if we hire this person?
No. Two different divisions, two different funding mechanisms. The water and sewer funds are kept separate and collected separately. The water funds, in regards to A4, and I'll kind of divert a little bit with you there briefly, right now this is the lowest delivery percentage ever received in the state water project. We don't anticipate that what we're doing right now is our normal day-in, day-out future workload. We're all kind of hoping and praying that it doesn't continue like this, because my guys are getting tired. I mean, we're working them pretty hard. With the collections department in this position that we're looking at, this is looking at our day-in, day-out future workload. And that day-in, day-out future workload, we think, is changing. It certainly has changed significantly since 2006, and the requirements have come down from the state to change what we were doing. We were doing a lot of these things, but we didn't have a formal policy or procedure in place. So we're augmenting our actual workload, and we're looking at a day-in and day-out need to have that position. But then our revenue stream will catch us back up. So we don't think we're going to need to change our rate structure based on this position at all.
My final question would be, why would I vote for this now instead of waiting until 2011?
The risk is not what we're doing, it's what we're not doing. It's opportunity cost. And so you go, if we wait till 2011 to start, for example, chasing INI in the collection system, we'll design a wastewater treatment plant that's accounted for all of that INI. We'll split the cost with Cayucas based on us using all of that flow into our plant. The cost here is the opportunity cost, and that it's the things we're not getting done that are the reason to pursue this position right now, and that our division wants to do a good job. They want to meet our commitments to the state. They prepared this plan, put a lot of work into it, and we're using that plan to sort of change from some of the past work practices and modernize our division. But we're realizing also that we can't do it all with the current crew that we have. From my perspective, I think it's an important thing to kind of look at and go, okay, if you got more work than you can possibly do, that hurts morale a little bit. And it would be, I think, very productive for this division to have staff that matches the workload, the budget's there in place, anticipated, and we're basically saying, hey, we choose to meet our commitment that we committed to when we adopted the SSMP. So that would be my case for you.
Okay. Any other questions? Comments? No?
I'll lead off, and just want to start by thanking Mr. Wade and his department for putting together these cost projections and bringing back more information. I voted against this hire last round. as I have been fairly consistent with for new proposed hires, mostly due to the my interest in a two-tiered benefit concept in place before we move forward to start to address those long-term costs. I'm still very hopeful that that will eventually be included, and therefore am uncomfortable authorizing this this hire. But at the same time, I do agree with Mr. Wade's assessment that this work is there for us to do now. It's really important for us to begin, especially with the INI issues, to address that. And seeing the breakdown that you've given us about what the cost would be to the community through a contractor, it makes it much easier to swallow. It's not easy to swallow, but it helps it go down. So at this point, I'm willing to do to go forward with this hire.
Okay, Carla.
Yeah, I want to thank you also, Dylan, for the information. I said make it compelling for me. And you certainly did. I appreciate the efforts that you're making to work more efficiently. I think that speaks volumes for the direction that you're heading. And I certainly agree. As I see the trucks out around there, I have a real concern for the safety when they're out in the middle of the streets, just as I do any of our public safety when they are in the middle of a road with cars going by. They're more inclined to watch what's going on than watch where they're driving. So there is a huge concern I have for that. And I appreciate the projections of the potential cost savings, and hopefully if we're able to approve this position, you'll keep an eye on the contract labor then. Hopefully that'll be cut some.
Rick?
It's clear to me we need this position, and it's also clear that we need it now. Dylan's going to need all the help he can get. So I'll vote in favor of the addition and hiring of the new wastewater collections operator.
Betty?
Can I ask him one more question?
Sure.
Referring back to this comment about contracting, will this cut back on the contracting that you do out of this department?
It will, to a limited extent. I mean, we'll realize whatever savings. We'll do all the work we can with our crews. Where we're at, though, is we're in the kind of the catch-up area on our collections system. And so you go, our expenditures right now, because we're sort of in that peak of the bell curve where things are failing faster than we're putting them back together, our expenditures probably still go up for the next few years. As we sort of get through that and as we burn through that backlog of projects that we have, our expenditures, so we will get, you know, I guess the easy way to say this is we're going to look worse before we get better. But the investments that we're making, the technologies that we're using to rehab our system, in the long term are a lot more cost effective than sort of digging it up and replacing it. So you go kind of long term, we have this short term period where we're making significant investments. Once we've gone through though and rehabbed the whole system one time, we don't need to do that again for 20 or 30 years. We kind of enter a maintenance phase and our costs will come back down. So I would anticipate the next 2, 3, 4 years as we do the
living in Morro Bay's drinking water, Dylan. It's the Dylan Show tonight.
Yeah, this is like a monologue. but you made Jim's evening.
Thank you.
And hopefully we keep him around a little bit longer because of that. He's doing a good job. All right, this is another item that's been before you before. We talked a little bit about emerging contaminants. And there's this whole class of emerging contaminants, pharmaceuticals, personal care products. Councilmember Grantham had done a lot of work kind of investigating, reading up, learning about this, and presented to me a list of 18 chemicals to go out there and try to find a test for. So last time we talked about this, I committed my staff, my huge crew, to go out and do this. So we worked on it. We contacted a number of labs. We spoke to about 4 labs. A lot of them can't do this work. What we learned is that the federal government has access to better labs than we do. Which is not surprising, I guess, but we did learn that through this process. So what we found is that you go, of the list of 18 chemicals that were out there, we have the ability to commercially test for 5 of those 18. The cost to do that test is $431 per testing event, plus staff time. And what I mean by plus staff time is, you know, somebody has to go out, grab the sample. Somebody has to mail those samples to the lab. Somebody has to collect the results and interpret them when they come back. So I would assume a couple hours of staff time. So estimate, I sent you an email today. I said call it $580 per test that we do to determine if these substances exist in our water supply. My suspicion is that we're going to find them, to be very frank. We're testing at very minute concentrations. We're testing at parts per trillion, which is a very small concentration. The best available knowledge right now is we don't think that this is going to have any long-term health effect. The community, medical community, and the drinking water community doesn't think that these things cause actual harm at very, very low trace levels. But it wouldn't hurt us to sort of reach out there and test. I'm kind of all for it. I think we could do it once now. Now we're operating a little bit differently than we normally do in that we're more dependent on groundwater. We're using our brackish water reverse osmosis system. Normally we're mostly state water. So my recommendation is if you guys want to get a feel for what emerging contaminants might be out there, that we would test now at our main King's Tank West site, which is where all of our water comes in before it goes out to the system. And then we would test again maybe later in the year once state water's back on to kind of figure out what's in state water. What that would do is that would let those members of the public that are concerned about this, at least then we would have some data. What can we do about it? Well, there's sort of very minimal treatment technologies available to do anything about it. Our RO system is about the best sort of treatment out there. We can use advanced oxidation techniques potentially, but those are very expensive. And we don't know that there's any health benefit of doing that at this point. And so you go, I look at it as sort of an informational exercise. We can reach out. If you guys want to do that, we can test our system for this. And my suspicion is that we'll find something. And once we find it, we'll report it to the community. And those people who are concerned about it can take whatever action they deem fit. I'm not sure what action you would take, but you could take some action if you deemed it so fit. So my recommendation is, why not? Well, let's spend, $580 twice. In the $4 million budget, it's not a significant expense. We have a significant testing expense already. We spend a lot of money on testing our water quality. And because we can, maybe we should. So I'll leave it to your discretion. If you want to test for it, we can. We can test for it as frequently or infrequently as you want to. There's no regulatory requirement here. This is something that we're doing above and beyond the mark just to sort of satisfy our own curiosity.
So the $580 covers all 19 of these potential?
No, it only covers the five that I could find.
Okay. So, all right, go ahead. You make your comment.
Thank you very much. Thanks, Dylan. First of all, just want to clarify a couple of typos. I want to make sure we test for the right things if we do. The carbamazine is, there's a, it's actually CARBAMAZEPINE. Is the one that I was interested in getting looked at. And then on the bottom list of the other things, there's only one T in the triclosan. So if we want to mark out one of those T's. In one of them, Noah, you were talking about phenol earlier. That's one of the five that we wanted to, I wanted to take a look at. The carbazine is more of an anticonvulsant and mood stabilizing drug used in manics drinking. And so there's only needs to be one testing location. And also, we did talk about the state water, and the state water is or the large municipality water systems is what the federal government tested a couple of years ago at those 14 different municipalities. And found contaminants at different levels in there. So I spoke with, after I got this, I got a hold of Environmental Health Department in SLO, Rich Lichtenfeld, and he feels, as I do, that those five would give us what he calls a good human footprint. And so I would be happy with the five,
and maybe just including the acetaminophen in that, because that's used in so many other products. So I would be happy with the one testing location on the water that we're using now, and then when state water comes, I'd like another test done on that. Final product only.
Okay. Other comments? Questions?
I don't have a question.
Okay.
And Mr. Wade answered it, but I'm not sure I understood. That would be me, not you. When I was asking about the unregulated contaminants in that top paragraph, what are those that they're asking us to do? Because if they're ones that we don't have to do, we're doing that as a favor to them. I didn't understand how that works.
Yeah, let me clarify that. That's a good point to make. The EPA has a process. So every year they go through, it's not every year, every 5 years they go through and they create a contaminant candidate list. Also, they go through what they call the unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, and they do that. It's also on a 4 or 5 year cycle. Memory, I don't remember exactly which that is. The unregulated contaminant monitoring rule, what they do is to the large water systems, they send out a list every few years and they say, hey, take some tests. Test once per quarter for the next year. We just got finished with a batch of it. Test for these chemicals. We think they may exist in the environment or in your sources. And so we have an obligation when they do that to test for all of the chemicals that they require us to test for. And that list changes every few years. What they then do is they use that list and the contaminant candidate list. They go through and they kind of, the experts get together and they argue about which chemicals need to be regulated, which ones carry the greatest health risk. All water regulations are based on sort of a cost-benefit analysis, and that you look at health risk versus cost of treatment and make an educated decision about which contaminants to regulate and which ones to let go. So we have a formal process that we go through, and that's the unregulated contaminant monitoring rule. Because we're a large water system, they require us to participate in that. We don't get out of it. We don't get any choice of the chemicals. We just get to do it. This emerging contaminant test that we will be doing is not a requirement by the EPA. It's not a requirement for California Department of Public Health. It's really looking at things that just now are being discovered to be persistent in the environment and looking at our water system and seeing if any of those are in there. But my suspicion is, and my assumption would be, is that yes, because of our source waters, there probably are some trace contaminants in our drinking water. There's the treatment that we use, even the best treatment, doesn't get all of this out of there. And at those extremely low concentrations, it's likely to be found. It's been found to be pretty prevalent kind of across the country when it's been tested for.
And what they have, the group of contaminants you've just been testing for are not related to the group that is being in this 5 group.
Correct.
Other questions, comments?
Yeah, I just had a question regarding the testing procedure and the potential of us pulling one test off of the existing groundwater sources and then another off of state water. What would be your concern there that we'd the snapshot that we'd take of that specific water line or stream at that very moment could perhaps be significantly different further down the line, you know, a half hour or a certain amount of time? And would we want to, just so we're maximized the results here and feel more more stable with those results, would we want to do two separated by a day or two just to give us a little more value there and strength in the numbers that we're getting?
Part of the reason for picking the sampling location that we would test at the King's Tank West. The way that our sources work, all of our sources come into that tank, blend into that tank. Right now, that tank farm represents about 2.5 to 3 days of demand. So effectively, we've got a 3-day volume of water caught there. So I'm comfortable in that testing it right now.
Okay, Bridget, you okay with that? Okay. All right. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Okay. Can we move along? C3? discussion regarding alternative biosolids management options, and this is Noah.
All right. Thank you very much. Continue the trend here tonight of eyes wide open, any subject goes. This is an item that we did have on a previous council agenda. I brought it forward outside of the JPA, Cayucos Moro Bay Board, because this is something that has been a pride for the community with our biosolids composting operation. And as we transition into the future with the new plan that is scheduled to be terminated. So I felt like it was important for us to have a little bit of time to talk about potential options within our management of our biosolid stream and to pull it away from the Cayucos Moro Bay JPA so we as a board could have a moment to talk about it and reflect on some options there. And so with this item, I've done some legwork talking with our staff, talking with county staff, and other individuals around the community that have spent a fair amount of time looking at the biosolids discussion. At this point, the existing plan with our biosolids with the new project is to truck the biosolids, subclass B biosolids, which is an adjustment from the higher grade of biosolids that we were attaining with the old plants, truck those wet to San Joaquin Composting in Kern County. At a projected savings because of the reduced staff time involved that was utilized during the composting process. Another element to why that is proposed is because of the floodplain analysis and the space limitations that we have in the existing site. The biosolids composting operation was deemed to be not enough, that we did not have enough room for that operation. So I would definitely like to give Mr. Keough a chance to chime in here, and I will ask him to do so at a couple points, but I don't consider myself, even with the amount of time I've spent reviewing this, an expert on this issue, although I do have some interests. What I guess I'd like to do just briefly is talk a little bit about what I think would be helpful for us as we go forward from the city's perspective. We have up until this point been the only composting waste biosolids composting program in the county at wastewater treatment plants, which has earned us appropriate accolades and attention around the state because of its leadership values. And although there has been some concern, we've had a very successful take-back program where people have taken advantage of the free composted biosolids and used them in landscaping and other applications. So that is something that I think is significant. I personally hold some concerns about the impacts to basically our air resources and the climate with a trucking operation all the way to Kern County. Initially, my hope was that we could determine a transitionary location for our biosolids composting program and maintain it in-house in the community and take advantage of the knowledge base and awareness that our existing staff has built up as they've as they've produced the compost and managed the program. And I still would be interested in entertaining that concept. I'm not sure, and I doubt that that's what the majority of the council or the JPA board would want to take the time to fund or evaluate at this point. So a couple of the really specific recommendations or possible actions that I'd like to for us to consider tonight that could help limit our impacts on the environment as far as trucking and give us a chance to continue some elements of leadership when it comes to composting within the community. So one that I'd like to start with, and I'd actually invite Mr. Keough to talk a little bit about, we've had a conversation, is there are some more proximate options for us with biosolids composting potentially, and we have investigated those in the past. They're in northern Santa Barbara County. Engel and Gray is the name of the firm that offers potentially composting operations from Mr. Keough's previous discussions, and I think I
at the Board of Supervisors for a few minutes, but most people it's kind of out of sight, out of mind, and you know, it's a good conversation to have because as we've kind of focused on the water end of the wastewater treatment plant, the solids end kind of gets left behind, and there's really two separate waste streams that we're dealing with. You know, I just want to point out that as far as the technology that we're using for the upgraded treatment plant, it may not be real conducive to composting even if you had the room, based on the proximity of neighbors to the site, because it's kind of a different technology, and the solids come out in a little bit different, for lack of a better term, stable. They might be slightly more odor and potential for flies using the Oxditch or even MBR technology. That's something we wrestled with in the facilities master plan. As far as the end use of the product, I don't think that at least at the treatment plant, that anybody's stuck on either San Joaquin Composting or Engel and Gray. Both of those firms are very capable of composting the material that's produced. They are currently composting biosolids, both of those facilities, from Santa Barbara, L.A., probably Ventura County. So either one is fine. We've always operated kind of on, you know, we've always shot for the lowest price. And basically when we would solicit quotes from the two firms, we would say, hey, you know, this is what we want to get done. What are you going to charge me? And they come back and say, hey, it's X amount of dollars per wet ton. Whatever we, you know, they take you to the truck scales, you weigh it, you pay for it. Engel and Gray has consistently been about $3 a ton higher than San Joaquin Composting. And I've always been, you know, and unlike the contract we discussed the other night, a lot of these vendor type quotes are based on low bid. And so I would assume maybe with Rob's help, you know, maybe you could write that into the scope of work, that you're not really looking for the low bid here, but put together the combination of values that gets you where you want to go. But either one of them, I think, is more than capable of reusing that material and composting it.
I'll tag in on that to follow up with what Bruce just said. Approximate cost difference at $3 a wet ton is several thousand dollars a year. It's not a make it or break it deal. I think you're currently spending $15,000. So it's probably $2,000 a year. The contract amount is such that you go, it wouldn't fall really under public contracts code for the competitive bidding process. You wouldn't have to necessarily, if it was a construction contract that you considered it to be, you wouldn't have to pursue competitive bidding. But it's not really a construction contract, and it's basically a vendor services contract. And I would look to our purchasing agent. I think we're setting a precedence there that we may need to be cautious about, in that now we're not selecting vendors based on price, and that opens you up. I would also look to Rob to kind of comment if you deem so fit, but it could open you up to all sorts of kind of complaints or concerns that your whatever process you do use, you would need to formalize. And so you would need some kind of value scale to determine the benefit of that would consistently be applied, so that you're not accused of favoritism or anything like that.
Rob, did you have a comment on that?
No, only that you give us the direction. If that's where you want to head, then we'll look to make sure that legally we can do it, whatever procedures we can do. I wouldn't want that to be the stumbling block if that's what council wants us to pursue.
And could we reference the climate action plan as an element to why we would make that decision, reduce carbon impacts, so on? Is that connection there for us as the basis to the decision?
I'm sure you could make findings to that effect.
So I would like to...
Rick had a question related to that.
Excuse me. Bruce, just a quick three-part question here. how often does that truck make the trip to Kern? How big is the truck and how much material usually goes along with it?
We currently, the way that we operate right now, we tend to dry biosolids during the spring and summer months into the fall. We test that material. Once we get the test results back, we call the trucking company. They quote us, and then they generally haul it all in a 1 to 2 day period. We're talking like this last year, we had 6 trucks, and each truck is probably capable of moving 25 yards of material, something like that. It isn't like we're doing it all the time. When we get to the new treatment facility, you're going to transition to a different solids handling process. You're going to mechanically dewater solids. You probably don't have a lot of storage standards for composting facilities and various industrial facilities. San Joaquin Composting will have to transition to a different style of composting, and they're actually in the process of trying to permit an incinerator right now. So they would basically take the majority of the biosolids they're currently composting, and they would burn them at that facility to generate electricity. The potential downside to that being a client is that I'm going to guess this last year we might have paid someplace around the $40 a ton mark for the biosolids that we did haul. The incineration cost may go as high as $90. It's a very capital-intensive project, and I think they're looking to get their money out of it once they start doing it. So you're going to pay more to incinerate it than you are to compost it. But I don't have firm numbers on that yet. I just know that I've had that discussion, and the numbers were significantly higher for the incineration in the valley.
And when you had mentioned that it was $3 more per ton or whatever unit it was to go to Santa Maria rather than to the valley, did that include transportation costs?
Yeah, the lion's share of that $40 a ton is actually transportation. I think when we did the facilities plan, they estimated that like if it was $42, it was $22 was, I believe, transportation, and the other 20 may have been tipping fee. Mm-hmm. But both of them are quoting on the same thing.
Okay. And could you just clarify, and I don't know who needs to answer this, who the County Regional Biosolids Management Plan work group is?
Yeah, it's an informal group right now that and I don't even know that I would call our group the Regional Biosolids Management Plan work group, but it's been a working group of representatives from local wastewater treatment plants. And the primary driver for getting people together was County Board of Supervisors actions and ordinances that were being developed concerning biosolids, and one of the recent ones was the conservation and open space element that the board is looking at right now has biosolids language in it, and we have met to discuss an organized front on how to approach the board and try and to prevent, it's kind of damage control for some of the public relations and or ordinances that have been put forward. But it's not really a stakeholders group where you'd have a whole bunch of different organizations represented. The county does have a biosolids task force that was organized probably about 8 to 10 years ago, and out of their work came the interim ordinance that's currently in order, and that is I think there might be 35 or 40 people on that. That's a very diverse stakeholders group.
Thank you.
So Bruce, it would seem to me economically we're probably doing the prudent thing now by shipping the biosolids once a year, but when we go to this new system, we'll have decreased areas of operation, which is going to necessitate maybe once a week, and then it might be more cost effective to use a closer place like Noah's talking about if we're doing all these more frequent trips, even though we might be paying a couple of more bucks per ton.
Yeah, I think you're just going to have to put that one out to a quote when the time comes, and I'm assuming they're going to sharpen their pencils a little bit just because of the volume of material that you would be generating. And I would imagine if you tried to secure a longer-term contract, that they may come down a little bit on price if you gave them a, you know, a 5 or 10 year deal. So there's some, they're locked into it for some period of time.
Okay. Carla, you got comments or questions? Okay. Noah, go ahead.
Thank you. The other thing that I think is important to recognize, and we all do, with the trucking costs, in a situation that we saw with elevated gas and fuel prices last summer, those costs would obviously impact the price and the difference of mileage between Kern and Santa Barbara County. So at this point, I'd like to, Mr. Keogh's said that as we get closer, we would want to reevaluate and receive bids. What sort of formal motion would you like tonight, or do you feel like the discussion's enough to look at ways we could not only look at the lowest bid but also the highest value for the community?
Just that. I mean, providing us with direction, exactly what you want us to bring back at a later time.
Okay. And I'd like to follow that up with a couple other comments on other items. So perhaps before we make that, really just to see if the council in general is interested in proposals from this organization, and you know, something more formal as an introduction to what they're trying to do, and if we're willing to perhaps at some point allow them to piggyback on our biosolids hauling with occasional post-consumer or pre-consumer organics composting as well. So it's more at this point just are we willing to entertain proposals from them and give them that invitation, I guess, or opening. And I just want to make sure there wasn't any concerns about that from the council. Okay, great. And let's see, make sure we've got everything. The other thing that I just wanted to mention tonight is definitely, even though we would be moving these biosolids out of the community most likely, it's still important for us to be aware of what we are flushing down the toilet and the drains. And we have some really interesting developments coming forward where potentially we will have a pharmaceutical take-back program in our community. So that is really exciting, and we'll definitely keep you posted on that as it goes along. So to close out this conversation tonight, I would like to make a motion that we direct staff to develop the opportunity to evaluate biosolids hauling contracts based on lowest bid and also other factors important to the community, such as climate impacts and local management of the material.
Okay. I'll second that, and I have a question.
Okay, what's the question?
It's actually for Mr. Schultz. The way that the motion was phrased, it's doing a comparison between lowest cost value, and you identified some things that might be going to this value thing that we were introduced the other night, actually, at the JPA. So it was my impression from the JPA that we had to go with the value process. And what I'm hearing is that that's a choice. I'm not understanding the distinction here.
There's all sorts of nuances with the law onto which type of contract you're doing. What you approved the other night was a design contract for professional services, which is dealt with under the government code section. I can get that for you, but that deals specifically with contracts for design professionals, architects, and engineers. What we're talking about here is a vendor or supplier agreement, which falls under a different type of procedure you have to follow, and how we can vary from that procedure if there's any ordinances or resolutions we'd have to pass to deviate from that. So the one you did the other night, completely different scenario that you do, that you have to go through a separate process than you would, just as the one that's most difficult that you have to comply with, and there's nothing really you can do on that also, is the construction contract, which is dealt with under the public contracts code, which requires you definitely to pick the lowest responsible bidder. So that's a contract. So there's all sorts of nuances, whether you're dealing with a vendor, supplier, design professional, attorney, that are all dealt with a little differently. Question here, this is more the vendor, and how much can we deviate from that under our current ordinances, or maybe with just a change in our ordinances, it's something we could do, and that's just, I don't know the answer to that. I'd have to research it.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay, any more discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? None. Okay. Thank you, Noah, for doing that. As Bruce said, it's not a sexy subject, but it's certainly one that we have to be concerned with, so thank you. All right, and then we move to item C4. And this is approval of resolution adding to and amending the Council Policies and Procedures Manual regarding the expense reimbursement policy for elected and appointed officials, city letterhead, and the Council Compensation Committee. Andrea.
I actually forgot this was my item. This was brought back to you. We have made some, actually the council over the past couple of years have made some changes to the policies and procedures manual, and we are asking you tonight to adopt a resolution to accept those changes, and I'll go over those changes very briefly. Back in, actually, 2007, you approved a lengthy resolution specifically regarding expense reimbursement policy for elected and appointed officials. And we took the bulk of that resolution, actually the entire resolution, and inserted it into your policy and procedure manual. And you'll see those the highlighted in Chapter 2, Section 2311, going all the way through to Section 2411. And I think that we tried to put the sections from the resolution that you...
if I have a couple of those.
Sure. Anybody else?
A couple others.
Did you find it? I'm sorry. Bridget, did you find it? It's on page one.
Yeah, got it. Okay, I've got that one.
Okay.
If we have a few of them, do you want us to talk about them now? Or
how many is a few?
I we have two. Run
through. Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, page 4, or actually page 3, excuse me, under 2.4.8, third line down, reservations by following the, it says say procedures, said procedures, I believe. If you'd like to go ahead, Carla, I'm going to locate my second one. Okay, let's see. And then the other was under attachment 2. Oh, you already pointed that out. Okay, great. Okay.
Okay.
All right. I have some content questions. Content that I'd actually like changed.
All right.
And it's in the old resolution, old being. What we passed in 2007, and I guess I want to go to the blue section where that's been inserted into our current document. And what was bullet
Council center. Member? I'm sorry. Excuse me. Are you on attachment 2? Which is probably the best way to look at it. Attachment 2 is the actual chapter 2. Oh,
yes.
Perfect.
Yes.
Excuse my interruption.
No, that's fine. Under those bullets. Under 2311, at the top of the page, I find the bullet that states at the end, implementing a city-approved strategy for attracting and retaining businesses. I don't understand what that means, and so I think it's too nebulous, and I'd like it removed or restated in for whatever the intent is. And then I have one more after that, if there's discussion on that.
Are there any examples as to what that might refer to? I mean,
here's a situation if a council member, let's say perhaps a new business came in or a proposal and a council member and a staff member all went to lunch to talk about the business.
If we did have a city-approved strategy, we have passed resolutions about the Embarcadero and making sure that we retain those, and I can't remember all the whereases, but if there was a strategy in that we were trying to implement, then this would be an approved expense.
Couldn't you put that under 2.5.3 is special expenses category?
I don't have a...
Yeah, that would work, wouldn't it?
2.5?
I don't have a 2.5.3, I don't believe.
Well, it's in the original one. That's where I got it from.
No.
Because when we were talking about the chamber installation dinner, that's where I found the rationale or the justification for it was under... or 2.4.1.
Yeah, 2.4.1. That
thank you. The other special expenses. Yeah, and that's the dinner.
So
official
if it's covered
city
under
business,
that,
yeah.
We wouldn't need it.
Right, we wouldn't need it. Yeah. Where Betty just pointed out.
Yeah. I guess the point, it sounds to me the question is whether or not you want to include that or not, not where it...
Well, I think what Carla was saying, what I kind of agreed to, is it's covered by 2.4.1 without being specific, right? Am I understanding you both correctly?
Yes. Okay. That's
right,
where it says
so
connection with
out.
Official city business.
I understand. It's fine.
Okay.
Sorry, I gave you the wrong number.
Thank you for finding that. The other one is under 232, still in attachment 2 on page 24, where it talks about spousal registration fees and the top of the next page, meals for spouses. For me, I don't think the city should be buying spouse meals or registration. It's great that if spouses want to go, but it almost contradicts for me how we don't do that on the next page under 243, that we need to stick with just sponsoring the person that represents the community.
Yeah.
I agree with you.
I do too.
So the concept would be to...
eliminate that second bullet on the bottom section on page 24, 232, and then apparently the last bullet or the last bullet in that section, but it's on the top of page 25.
This whole section deals with spousals.
Yeah,
the whole
yeah.
section is, if you want it completely removed, we'll remove the entire section.
That's fine.
Well, I don't think I want to remove the entire section, but I think we can just remove those two items out of it.
Each bullet point is dealing with spousal.
Yes.
Every single bullet point. So I'm not sure what you'd have left except for
we
the
left
city
the
shall reimburse the cost of participating in the annual conference for the League of California Cities. Well, that's already under other items. You take out everything else in that whole, because everything else deals with spousal. What they're telling you is double rooms instead, the spousal registration fee, the travel expenses would be paid for the spousal. And so if you want all of
it
out, you just take the whole section out.
Then can we just put the double room part someplace else?
That's negligible.
Well, I know it's negligible, but I think it's fair to say, you know, you don't have to register separately to take your spouse along.
I think it makes...
There is... I don't know of any hotels anymore that have a difference between a double or a single. I've never seen that in the last 15 years.
It would make it challenging for the city to get the rate for a single and then the person to pay for the other difference. And so,
yeah
I would hope it would just be all-inclusive. We're not getting a suite. We're getting a Motel 6 room or whatever. So
we're just going to assume that that's okay. Okay.
I'm thinking that we're probably not going to go to that level of review on your receipts.
All right, so we're taking out 2.3.2 completely. And 2.3.3 as well? Yes?
Say the numbers again.
2.3.3 for Channel County's division meetings. That one too.
Okay, if it's related to spouses, you bet.
Yeah.
Nothing against spouses.
Easy for those of us who don't have one.
I have one more. It's on page 27. It's under 249. And the first fat paragraph is followed by a single sentence. Inability to provide such documentation in a timely fashion may result in the expense not being borne by the official. Yet in the previous paragraph, it says it has to be done within a 30 calendar days. So I just find that contradictory and was wondering if we could just lift those words within 30 calendar days of an expense being incurred and repeat that in the following line, or just delete the line, inability to provide such documentation within the 30 days may result in expense being borne. That way, Ms. Slayton isn't looking for something, you know, 10 months later.
Yeah.
But I think that sentence is probably needed, but if we could just eliminate in a timely fashion and substitute within 30 calendar days of an expense being incurred.
Or 60 days.
Well,
I'm just looking for some allowance of, I mean, we all get busy with things as we come back, and so it may not be your highest priority, but certainly understanding her need to balance the things. I hate to cut somebody out of their reimbursement opportunity.
Well, and two, if you put it on a credit card, you don't always get it right away. So.
Okay. So 60 days is fine for the second sentence then.
Anything else?
I actually do have one more. It's in the following section, 2410. Just curious about or planning commission. I don't know that we've ever made reports to the planning commission. And I assume since the document at the beginning says this is really related just to the council, that could we just cross out that parenthesis?
Do we have guidelines for the planning commission that are separate from this is what we need?
This policy was adopted as an ordinance, one that was in compliance with AB 1234, and we're now including it in the council's policies and procedures, but it's needed. At least I'd like to keep them consistent, because the Planning Commission, if they do go on any type of city business, since they are the ones that would do that, we left it in there. So it's actually applying to the Planning Commission, and that's the only reason why I leave it in there. Not saying you have to do the report to the Planning Commission.
Oh, okay.
But if Planning Commission uses expenditures, they're supposed to make that reporting. So we still have the ordinance of the original document. We're now including it in here, but I'd like for consistencies just to leave that in there.
No problem with that. Then do we need to change the title that says Council and Planning Commission then?
The Planning Commission is required to report also if they attend those meetings and have to report on it. If you're using city expenses,
but I
if it's paid for by the city, you have to report on it. Or you're supposed to report on it.
Well, you could just say at the next regular City Council or Planning Commission meeting, council members or planning commissioners shall each officially briefly report on the meetings.
Well, I think the language
has to be clarified. Yeah.
Is probably fine. My question was, should it be more in the title of the document to say that this represents not just council but also planning commissioners?
Benefits, and I wanted to make sure that we weren't required to recognize those here.
Where? I'm sorry. What section?
2.2, attachment 2, retirement, medical, dental, vision, and life insurance.
First page?
Yes.
Of attachment 2?
23.
And the adjustments that I see may be necessary, the second sentence, the city shall pay in full the cost of mayor, council membership's participation in health, dental, vision, and life insurance. At this point, our policy is to pay at the lowest rung of insurance for the council member only. So if they select a higher, if the council member selects a higher level of coverage within the options, they would be required or responsible to pay that or for additional family members.
If the council will allow us, what we'll do is amend that to currently reflect what we're doing. I don't have the language here, but if you're comfortable, we can go ahead and make that change without bringing it back to you.
I'm comfortable with that. The second, or the last sentence there, the third sentence, we have adjusted that as well as far as being able to take cash and negotiate.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else? All right. Are we ready for a motion? Well, I'll move.
Okay. Betty, you want to do it? Or you?
Okay. It doesn't matter. I move that we accept the amendments to the City Council approved resolution 1110 as amended.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Okay. And item D1, this is a resolution establishing the purpose of the Risk Management Fund. Susan.
Good evening, Mayor Peterson, council members.
Item D run addresses the city's risk management fund and staff's request that council adopt resolution number 13-10 setting the purpose and cash balance of this fund. The suggested cash balance is $500,000 and the remaining $2.4 million is recommended to be transferred to the general fund accumulation fund. By doing that, council will meet its reserve goal of 27.5% of general fund expenditures. The city purchases its insurance from the California Joint Powers Insurance Authority, which is CJPIA. All covered claims are processed by the CJPIA and paid for through our annual deposit. The CJPIA does not require a risk management fund, and the cash balance in the fund is currently $2.9 million. Staff estimates that $500,000 would be sufficient for any uncovered claims that may arise, and those types of claims would be land use claims or any type of personnel investigations. This ends my report, and I will be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay. Questions for Susan? Anybody? Comments?
I have a question, actually. Okay. The cost you said in here was $900,000 a year, between $700,000 to $900,000 a year. But you chose $500,000 rather than to keep in there for the items if we were to be have legal issues outside of the coverage at only $500,000. So I'm just not quite sure how you derived at that number versus covering the full amount of the $700,000 to $900,000 as a reserve, and or the fact that if there was some legal action, could potentially be more than $500,000 on land use issues if we were found at fault.
Thank you for the question. The $900,000 is the cost of our insurance, and we pay those premiums twice a year. We pay an initial deposit in July, and then we pay our earthquake insurance closer to September and October. Those are our two big insurance payments, and that usually that comes to about $900,000. We then collect that money from the departments on a monthly basis. So that $900,000 is pretty much reimbursed in the year. The $500,000 we talked about, staff talked about amongst itself, and we decided that would be a very comfortable balance to keep, actually almost to the point of being excessive. We've had, I believe Mr. Schultz said, one land use claim, and we have had one personnel action that we had to take money out of the risk management fund, and it was under $10,000.
Any other questions?
So each department pays a fair share of the insurance premium out of their budget.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Well, we're moving along positively today. Item D2, consideration of an amendment to Morro Bay Municipal Code regarding the duties of the city attorney. We're giving you more work.
Yes, this is in front of you based on Councilmember Winhelt's interest in expanding the city attorney's duties to include any time there's an appeal at the Planning Commission level. I certainly agree it doesn't happen that often. You know, you say it doesn't and then all of a sudden it does. Most cities, I would say, do have the city attorney at every single Planning Commission meeting, but they're also on an hourly basis or they have a larger staff. But it's certainly something that I've said I've always tried to do, and I think I will be doing in the near future, going to more Planning Commission meetings, but certainly putting this in the duties, I'm fine with that and making certain that staff knows that at the planning that if something's appealed. These appeals that are at the Planning Commission level are appeals that would come from the administration level as far as an coastal development administrative permit or a minor use permit, or even, I guess, a tree removal would be an administrative decision that could be appealed to the Planning Commission. So that's when it occurs. Doesn't happen that often, but I think it is good because at that point in time it can be elevated into the appeal level, which can result in litigation later on if all procedures aren't followed correctly. So I'm in favor of it, and if there's any other changes to the city attorney's duties, you can also talk about that also.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? Nothing?
No, I have a comment. I'm going to vote no just because I'm not interested in regulating it, and this stemmed from two appeals because I just coincidentally happened to be at the Planning Commission meeting that night one denied and one upheld. And I feel like I'm just going to speak to it because I've been there as an appellant against a project before, and my recourse when I was denied my appeal was to appeal to the City Council. So I think that there are checks and balances in place, and that's why we appoint an advisory board that we select from our community to do that. So for me, I feel like then that undermines the process that they're charged with. So just for the record, that's why I'll be voting no.
I would respond to that. I think the reason why I think it's important is for that reason, that if you're doing an appeal from administration, then how can administration be unbiased because it's their decision? And so you need someone else who needs to be there to say, yeah, you're following the rules. And I think that I'm assuming that the city attorney would be objective and be the intermediary there rather than expecting staff to defend themselves against a public appeal.
Yeah, I would not be supplementing the commissioners anyway. It would just be certain that the procedural rules are being followed.
Okay. Any further discussion? All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? I'm sorry, yes, with Councilmember Richard opposed. Okay, future agenda items. Anyone?
I don't know if it's really one item. I was cleaning through some papers and found some old notes. And back in 2009, we had formed a business ad hoc committee. I'm sorry.
Can we go back to the last one? Made a motion. You just said all in favor.
I'm sorry. There was no motion?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll make a motion that we amend the Morro Bay Municipal Code regarding the duties of the city attorney as suggested.
Second.
Okay, and now all in favor.
Aye.
Okay. Thank you. All right, Betty, go ahead. A business something?
Yes, back in February of 2007, we discussed forming an ad hoc committee to determine which businesses would be viable for Morro Bay and to recruit them. I think Mr. Pierce at that time, mm-hmm. and I don't know who else was it? With him on that. Since it's an ad hoc committee, I'm just raising it. Is this a defunct committee now, or is this something that we need to appoint people to? And then along with that is we had also talked when we were dealing with the fire contract with the state. I had made a motion to include the formation of a committee made up of council members, staff, and frontline firefighters to form a committee. And I don't think that if that's ready to be formed now. Also, that was back in April.
And what was the purpose of that one, too? Was it 2007?
No. This was in March of 2009.
Oh, okay.
And the other one was in, I think, January of 2009.
Okay. I do remember the discussions. I don't remember the timing, what we said the timing would be.
Mayor.
And I think the Amador thing, didn't Chief Pond go ahead?
I just asked him about it tonight.
Okay.
He said that at this point that Mr. Jenkins has been not able to provide any opportunities. And he said that he would be directing either a update to the entire council or via the city manager to us. I just asked.
So if we brought both those issues back together for update, discussion, appointment, whatever.
I think the Amador is a separate issue.
Right, but if we brought them both back for discussion to update us on what's happened with the Amador issue and whether there has been any movement by the chief to form a committee, right?
Well, I think we would know if they were had formed a committee because we would be on it because the composition was to have two city council members on it.
I know. It's just the chief's not here tonight to respond to that. So if we bring it back with a report from him, is that okay?
As long as that and the business committee.
Okay. All right. Is that clear?
Mayor Peterson, I understand. What I think I hear you saying is that we'll bring back both items in one staff report, give a little bit of history about how the motion was made and what was the little bit of the history, and is there anything from this point, from that point to now that would change what you might do, and then make a decision at that meeting next time whether you want to appoint people to the committee or the committee's longer needed. Is that kind of the direction I'm getting?
That sounds good to me.
Okay.
All right. Any other future agenda items? Nope. Okay, Betty, you've got closing quote tonight.
In every community, there is work to be done. In every nation, there are wounds to heal. In every heart, there is the power to do it. Marianne Williamson.
Thank you. And we're adjourned.